Not really.
Our main speaker is here now. We'll start our panel discussion by some remarks from the author of the book, Will Bagley, from the editor of the book, and then we'll hear comments and questions from the panel and from the audience. We'll proceed with that.
Well, actually, I think we'll let Scott comment on the book because he's read a good bit of it anyway. It's a very large book. And I need to recognize my co-author, David Bigler, co-editor, because I think he was the inspiration, and certainly my inspiration, in doing the book. It's an incredible story, the epic of the Mormon Battalion. And it's really never been told except as sort of a watered-down religious pay-in to righteous young men. Well, as we note, I believe in the book, most of these guys were teenagers, and I think that speaks for itself. And to point out that Brigham Young did not send his favorite people away with the Mormon Battalion would probably be pointing out the obvious. But what these men accomplished in terms of the national character today is a major achievement. And the character of these soldiers in their service to the United States was exemplary. As Texas Rangers were slaughtering and raping Mexican civilians, these men and their conduct inspired an incredibly favorable reaction in California among the occupied Mexican population and among their fellow Americans, especially the Army officers whose task it was to rule over a newly conquered province that had been disastrously administered by such incompetent hacks as John C. Fremont and Richard Stockton, who had actually provoked a Mexican revolt. When Company B was about to march from San Diego in the summer of 1847, spring, to be discharged, the citizens petitioned the government to please replace them, please send someone here who can protect us from the Indians, first of all, but we've grown to admire and trust these men so much that we want to keep them, enlist them at any cost. And in fact, the United States government, specifically through the agency of General Stephen Watts Kearny, made an incredible effort to raise a second Mormon battalion. But problems with communication and the fact that Brigham Young needed people in Salt Lake and not in California derailed the proposition, plus the essential collapse of the Mexican military resistance, which was not obvious in the summer of 1847, pretty much put a kibosh on Captain Jefferson Hunt receiving a regular Army colonel's commission in the regular Army. Now, as I thought about it, David and I had worked on this subject for years, and we were both not crazy about the idea of returning to it again. And I'd approached virtually everybody with expertise on the Mormon Battalion to take on the job. John Yurtinus, I think, would have been a great candidate. Norma Ricketts declined doing it. So did Stan Kimball and Bill Hartley. But David quite graciously took up the march, and I followed him to try to link together the disparate threads that made up the Mormon Battalion. And I was quite surprised at what an interesting experience it was, because as we began to put the battalion in what we viewed as its proper context, the context of the American West and the American Republic, it became a completely different story. And as we let these men tell their stories, and we let the women express their sacrifice and the suffering that they endured for both their church and their country, it became not just a challenging intellectual exercise, it became a profoundly moving emotional experience, especially in dealing with these women's letters. They are direct and honest, and they ask very hard questions. Read Margaret Scott's letter, both of them, first to her brother, saying, "Do not leave me behind. You've promised to take me west. Come back and take me with you." And then the letter to Brigham Young asking why her brother had died in the face of the prophet's promise that if he remained righteous, he would return to the folds of the church. Powerful document to the cost of war. And then read the section, "We never got the money," and learn about the suffering of those women in winter quarters and their essential abandonment by the authorities who've taken on responsibility to care for them. profoundly moving materials. And when each of these women quite humbly asked their husbands to get them one thing, it brought me to tears at times. Each of these women, to survive a Midwest winter, want a cow. And I suspect that very few of them got it. But in the larger context of Mormon history, what these men did and the changes that they brought to Mormon culture, I found quite amazing. Again, remember, they were teenagers, most of them. They were very young. They were very impressionable. And their encounter with Hispanic culture, I believe, is one of the defining characteristics that will endure throughout the rest of the Mormon experience in the West. This is what John Steele wrote when he reached Salt Lake. "Our men that looked natural enough when they left Council Bluffs now look like mountaineers, sunburned and weather-beaten, mostly dressed in buckskin with fringes and porcupine quills, moccasins, Spanish saddles and spurs," which they called jinglers, "Spanish bridles and jinglers at them, and long beards, so that I looked in the glass for the young man who left the Bluffs a year ago, I would not have known myself." And in a profoundly revealing comment, he says, "Went away afoot, came home riding a fine horse." He left, actually Steele was Irish, and I won't even attempt the Irish brogue, but Steele left Council Bluffs with his companions, who were mostly Midwestern farm boys, and they came back transformed. They came back as the Mormon frontiersmen that would enable the Mormons to succeed in an incredibly challenging and harsh environment. I believe that encounter with Hispanic culture, the adoption of Mexican irrigation techniques, and even Mexican dress and language was profoundly important in the survival of Mormons in the West. We see battalion veterans who had seen irrigation in New Mexico, damming and digging the first ditches before Brigham Young arrives in the valley. Within days of Brigham Young's arrival, we see Brannan telling Brigham Young, "Use Adobe. I put up a print shop in 10 days and had a paper out in 12. And these young men who had also seen enormous Adobe constructions in their experiences showed them how to do it. So I believe that these experiences became key. And again, it was a problematic experience because, as older men and older generations will do, the existing Mormon hierarchy found these young men to be a threat. They hated the adoption of Mexican culture. And Brigham Young repeatedly denounced the battalion veterans as the lowest scrapings of hell. And he pretty much viciously attacked the women who were essentially asking for what he'd promised them. I've got a quote here that I probably should skip, but I will. But it's really heartrending to see the sacrifices that these men made, and then the prevarication and the obfuscation that follows any kind of honest recognition of their contribution. But it does come ultimately, and it comes when Brigham Young needs them. And he needs them when he decides that he will have to go to war with the United States. He does this after hosting a couple of companies of American soldiers in 1854-55 under Steptoe. And he then holds a big festival, and the Mormon battalion's reputation is essentially rehabilitated. And their contributions to the Utah War were quite substantial, although few of them were put into military commands, which mostly went to church hierarchy, whose military experience consisted of few battles in Missouri or mob action in Illinois. But anyway, let me show you the book. I'll show you the... it's Volume 4 in the Kingdom in the West series. We're serious about this 15-volume series. It's actually coming out at the rate of about a volume a year. I've actually calculated. I hope to have the thing completed by 2006, and I think we'll certainly make it by 2007. I don't believe people will be able to write Mormon history the same way again. And there's one other feature of the book that both David and I were delighted in. We've tried to find creative artwork for these books to show these people with their actual ages, that when they were actually engaged in what they were doing, and to the, so that young people will be corrected in the notion that old pioneers all had beards and the West was settled by geriatric cases. One of the most pleasing of our finds was a family portrait of Melissa Burton Corey Kimball, whose sacrifices and experience are as harrowing as any woman of the American West. And it occurred to me that maybe in a military history of the Hundred Years' War, you might find a woman on the frontispiece. But except for histories of American women's military units, I doubt you'll find any other military history with a woman on the frontispiece. And certainly, no one earned it more than laundress Melissa Corey, who also now has a Sierra Peak named after her for her astonishing contributions to the Mormon frontier. I'll try to show you the paperback, too. Yes.
Could you repeat the question?
This is an excellent question by Glenn Larson. What was John D. Lee's role in this? And in fact, Lee, the role of Lee and Howard Egan led David Bigler and I to make one of the, I think, three mistakes, two others are typos in Forgotten Kingdom, which was to identify Howard Egan as a Mormon battalion veteran. He wasn't. He accompanied Lee to pick up the money. This is David Bigler's book, second volume in the series, which won Best Book of the Year from Westerns International in 1998, correct me. But anyway, Lee was assigned to do a very important task, a very delicate task, go to Santa Fe and get the money that was paid out by the Army to the battalion veterans. And in fact, they were paid in checks. The Army was way behind in financing its operations. Many of the men signed over their checks to saloon keepers or sutlers. Some of them, absolutely having learned what had happened to their initial pay, refused to send it back to the church. But altogether, Lee collected, I think, either $5,000 or $10,000, incredibly valuable at that point in Mormon history, and took it back to Council Bluffs winter quarters. He was denounced by many of the men for charging a fee, I believe, to do some of this. But I think he carried money privately to other battalion connections. But his experience and his journal, I believe, may well be the best Lee journal in existence. We use it essentially starting with the text that Juanita Brooks published in the New Mexico Historical Quarterly, because it is as colorful and precise a description of American military unit in the Mexican War as exists. He talks about everything. The animals, the weather, the marching conditions, the tunes they used to march, the formations of the battalion. And then he gets involved in this incredible political squabble between the privates, who are the highest church authorities in the battalion, and who essentially are saying, we get to run the show, and the Mormon militia captains, who are faced with a difficult problem of replacing their commander. They pick a regular army officer, a lieutenant, who's wildly unpopular with the men, because he knows how to get the pay. He knows army regulations and can actually fill out the forms necessary to keep the unit fed and paid and on the march. Lee denounces this, and Levi Hancock, the only general authority with the battalion, challenges it. Lee, finally realizing that he's got to get that money, and that's his job. His job isn't to create a mutiny in the Mormon battalion, backs off. But I think Philip St. George Cook, who took command in Santa Fe, could have put Lee up against a wall and shot him for treason without a lot of subsequent problems. And as much as I regard Lee as a frontiersman, I wonder what subsequent problems might have been put to rest if Philip St. George Cook hadn't been such a good politician. But again, you see Lee in this book as unvarnished John D. Lee, and I think you also begin to realize why he was so important to the Mormon effort in the West and so valuable to Brigham Young. Anyway, I'll turn the time over to Scott. I think I probably used way too much. And at the end, I'd like to show off the...
You got plenty of time. We have another 40 minutes.
Oh, yeah?
Go ahead.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's let Scott talk. And I might go out and try to drum up some more people.
That's not a bad idea.
No, but we'll let Scott comment on it, and then I'll get up and talk as long as you guys will sit and as long as the time lasts. Thanks.
And then we'll take questions.
As Will has said, this is a very interesting story, that of the Mormon Battalion, and an important one in the opening of the American West. What I find particularly interesting is the way this story is told with this particular volume. And my comments here on the Army of Israel also pertain to the other volumes in the same series, because they are written the same way. There's an interesting use of documentation here that for me, it added a particular dash of flavor that you don't normally get in a narrative form of history. Norma Ricketts' book on the Mormon Battalion is a good example of a very well-written narrative history, and I enjoyed reading it very much. But this particular volume has been more interesting to me, because rather than having the historian telling me how people felt or what they thought, Will and David have actually provided the documentary evidence, letters, excerpts from journals, diaries, etc., in which the people speak for themselves. Now, granted, reading this type of history is a slower read. You don't move along at that clip that you can when you're reading a narrative, and you're basically being kind of spoon-fed history. This requires a little more thought, a little more dedication, and a great deal more attentiveness. And so for me, it's been very rewarding. I'm normally not that attentive. I tend to read, books in the bathroom and while I'm, eating dinner and what have you. I haven't started reading while I'm driving yet, although, that it may come to that. Hang on just one second. I meant to turn that off before I even came in here. I find it so intriguing that I'm able to read along, and the editors always introduce a document with a narrative explanation. So each document is introduced and explained, but then I actually listen to the voice of these people. And sometimes that's even unnerving. It truly is. I mean, as the Book of Mormon uses the phrase, a voice from the dust. And you realize that these people, you realize better than you can with a narrative that these were real human beings, flesh and blood individuals, who had fears, who had hopes, who had dreams, who are people that I can identify with so much more accurately and movingly, because I'm reading documents written by their hands. This also gives me the opportunity to disagree with the editors, because they may say, give me a brief explanation of a document and then tell me what this document means. And as I read it, I think, well, I can see where they're headed, but I see something else here that maybe they had not seen. I see some slant to this particular document that maybe hasn't been seen. So it's so very rewarding. I honestly normally would have shied away from any kind of documentary history, because in the past the documentary history that I've read has simply been kind of a dry and unguided collection of documents. And there's been no introduction. There usually is not an accompanying explanation of the documents. And these documents are organized not only chronologically but also topically, so that there's a rational flow to the information. And again, I can't say enough about how marvelous it is to read the actual words of these people. And when you read these documents, you realize that you're participating actually in the reliving of history. I find the whole series to be very enjoyable and very rewarding. Those are basically my comments. It's
well, thanks.
Do you have a? Do you have?
Yes.
I don't think it's going to go too far. Oh, yeah.
We appreciate Scott's comments. As a moderator now, I have some questions that might anticipate some of your questions, and if not, we'll take yours after. And we'll direct most of these to Will unless Scott has some comments. First of all, Will.
Let me comment briefly. Okay. On Scott. Scott and I are good friends, and I appreciate him taking the time to go through this book, and I'm delighted that he found it as rewarding as he did, because he's done exactly what we hoped readers would do. It's interesting. In the third volume, Scoundrel's Tale, the Samuel Brannan papers, I spent a lot more time introducing material. Partly it was a much more difficult problem because Brannan didn't leave a complete coherent set of papers. But Bunny Fontana of Arizona critiqued me for essentially telling people what the documents were going to tell them anyway. And as I read the first chapters that David edited, I was quite surprised to see how brief and telling his connecting narrative was. He didn't belabor anything, and he repeated very, very little. He let the documents tell the story, and the documents are these voices from the dust. It's the people themselves telling what happened to them. And it's a wide range of documents. It extends everywhere from official military reports to these very personal, compelling letters. But I'm delighted that Scott found it to be such a compelling experience, because we experienced this as we went through the material. It's absolutely astonishing, the depth of this material. And I believe you could probably do three or four more collections of almost equal quality, given the boundless, apparently boundless amount of material that was generated by these young and sometimes very old men. But head on.
Okay. Well, would you answer for the audience the question, what is today's repository of most of these documents? In other words, where did you have to go to do most of your research and to come up with all this primary documentation?
They're all over hell and back, to put it bluntly. The largest repository, I would guess, is probably the LDS Church. And we don't comment on this, but and I've only recently thought through its significance, but most of these Mormon Battalion narratives, even the journals, especially the journals, are not day-by-day diaries. They are later narratives constructed from the day books. And typically, the day books were then destroyed. And very often, the day books were assembled not by the men themselves, but by church clerks. And so there's a certain amount of revisionism that goes on in these documents themselves. Samuel Thompson's... I get Rogers and Thompson confused. But his journal is certainly rewritten by a church clerk. Probably as part of the effort to assemble Daniel Tyler's concise history of the Mormon Battalion, and which itself was actually edited by George Q. Cannon. So we sort of have a buffer between many of these documents, although you do get the 19th century Mormon viewpoint expressed much more eloquently than if they'd been reconstructed in the 20th century. But the number and the variety of these sources is astonishing. There's an incredible number of day books, diaries. Some of these day books actually do survive. Most of them are in a reconstructed form. But then there are many, many reminiscences. And they're generally much more revisionist than the journals themselves. Although you do have characters like Abner Blackburn who have fallen away and take a very humorous view of their youthful experiences. Some of these documents are just absolutely brilliant folk literature, and they evoke not just the Mormon Battalion experience, but this whole incredible experience of westering. One comment that I found very profound was when Paul Hutton, who's a respected national historian of the West, at a convention I was at in Minnesota, somebody noticed him on the street and walked up and said, "You're Mr. History," because Paul's always on TV talking about stuff. But he came and looked at some of the battalion documentation in LDS archives as part of research for a lawsuit, and he told me, he said, "Nobody who writes on Apaches can afford to ignore these documents." these documents touch on a variety of subjects. If you look simply at the Indian contacts, and generally they're much more precise than typical immigrant journals, which sort of lump all Indians into the general class Indians. Here you had very specific comments on Navajos, Apaches, Comanches, Pimas, Luisenos, who were the Shoshone relatives of our Great Basin Indians, all the way across the Great Plains, because the battalion, its geographic range was equally astonishing. I don't think we've ever quantified the number and variety of trails and routes that these guys were all influential in either traveling or opening. But the variety of material in these things is stunning. BYU has a very good collection. There are interesting materials at the Huntington Library, the Bancroft Library, the Beinecke Library, and a really forgotten repository for Mormon historians is the National Archives, which, of course, contains a pretty good set of records from the 10th Military District, which was established in California in 1847, or later, and all the records were dumped into it. In fact, there's a very interesting set of documentation on Mormon counterfeiting in California and the arrest of three veteran Mormon officers in the spring of 1848 for passing bogus. And my conclusion, I don't see how else they got it. Maybe they might have gotten it through Sam Brannan, but I think since one of these letters says Porter Rockwell was arrested with them, I think Port hauled bogus across the Mojave Desert, gave it to these guys. They started passing it in Los Angeles and got caught. And the rest is history, so to speak. But as I look at this, and this sentence was actually cut out of the book, I said, if you look at the broader history of Mormon counterfeiting, you'd have to either conclude that they were indeed making bogus, or frontier Mormons were relentlessly pursued from Missouri to Illinois to winter quarters to New York to California and finally back to Salt Lake, where the last great counterfeiting scandal explodes in 1859. So there's either this relentless band of counterfeiters who were determined to make the church look bad, or Mormons are actually running the bogus presses that Mary Eddy Green said she saw fall out of Peter Hawes' wagon as it toppled over crossing Iowa.
Thank you. Another question that arises is, you said that some battalion members beat Brigham Young into the valley, and yet Brigham Young was only 2 days behind Orson Pratt and the others. How soon did they get there, and were they the sick detachment, and also how did the sick detachment get to Salt Lake?
Well, the sick detachment, or we call it the detachments. There's three of them, and not all of them are sick. Some of them, Brigham Young, or some of them were just too much trouble. Thomas Williams was a sergeant, and I suspect that Philip St. George Cook heard the reports of him defying of insubordination and just sent him packing. He also had a black slave with him, I believe. Very interesting character. But the detachments go to winter in Pueblo. There are about 150 men, most of them old or sick or in some way debilitated, also with large families. And Cook was essentially stripping the battalion of its dependents. He only agreed to take five women to California, and only four of them made it. But the experience of these guys on the Arkansas River, or Arkansas River, as they would have called it, was incredible. They're out there preaching polygamy to the mountaineers, and they convert a bunch of these rough-and-tumble frontiersmen, very briefly, by the way. And then they set off, and they march up to meet Brigham Young. They get to Fort Laramie just 2 weeks behind him, and then they almost catch up with him. But the main unit reaches Salt Lake on the 29th of July. Operation. But there were 10 men, 12 men, I believe, with Thomas Williams, who were sent up to chase down Tim Goodale, a mountaineer who's stolen some of the mules that Williams stole from New Mexico. So they actually meet up with the Pioneer Company on Green River. I think that 2 days after Sam Brannan shows up, and his Wallace Stegner says, here you've got the three major prongs of Mormon westering finally coming together. And remember, the Pioneer Company didn't know what had happened to Sam Brannan. They had virtually no information except what Lee had brought them about the battalion. All they knew was the battalion was heading west. They didn't know if they'd reached California. So when these dozen men show up, I think it's either on the 3rd or maybe the 4th of July, there's a big celebration. They're greeted by hosannas because here it is, the battalion, at least part of it survived, and these men fall in with Brigham Young, and some of these men are among the, how many men is it? Better than 100 men that accompany Orson Pratt into the valley.
Okay, thank you. If anyone in the audience has a question, we'll take those now. If not, I have some more questions. And if you do have a question, could you please walk up to the microphone or it won't be recorded properly?
Or I'll repeat it.
Okay. Any questions from the audience?
The woman in back. When I refer to counterfeiting, am I talking about money? Yes, I'm referring to what are described as $5, $8, and $20 gold pieces. What Brigham Young, I think, called land office money. And I think they were probably reales. They were probably not American currency, but they were probably, given the denominations, Mexican reales, which were the common currency on the frontier. Yes?
Maybe you said this before I got here. You followed the battalion after mustering out back to Utah, and that
was the gold rush. The question is, do we follow the battalion through their incredible adventures after discharge? The answer is yes. In fact, we publish primary sources on major contributions of the battalion after their discharge that have never been printed before. We've got a wonderful narrative by John Reiser, a young German soldier, written in California in his old age, about opening the Salt Lake Los Angeles wagon road. Since we only had one other statement by Henry Boyle, it's about a sentence long, and a statement that Norma Ricketts printed by Reiser, this is very important material, and it helps us understand the route, which wasn't exactly the route that becomes the wagon road, or at least the variant that Rockwell takes. I think Reiser probably stuck pretty close to the wagon road. But we also track the gold discovery. We do a brief discourse on the later impact on trailblazing, and there's a very long chapter on the legacy of the Mormon Battalion where we track how the men essentially reunited with the church in Salt Lake Valley, what their experience was like. We take many of these men all the way back to winter quarters, some of whom arrived in December of 1847, having made an incredible march in about 18 months. We use the diary of a 15-year-old boy, son of an officer, to recount this incredible trek from Salt Lake to winter quarters from October to December, in which the men were reduced to eating parched corn at the Pawnee farms and the head of a mule. These are incredible sources. And we use Henry Bigler's Overland Monthly narrative of the gold discovery to essentially wrap up the California experience. And we point to the what's really the next volume in subject sequence, which will be West of Zion, Mormon Pioneers in the California Gold Rush by Ken Owens and Michael Landon. And they'll cover some of the later road building experiences. But the last document in the book is Azariah Smith's account of the Mormon Jubilee in San Francisco. And it provides a closure. And he is such a nice guy. And he is so naive and sweet. And he describes being lionized by California. And these Mormons had been in a confrontational stance for 50 years. They were not used to being celebrated as American heroes. But they put him in a carriage, and they have a big placard saying, "The Companions of Marshall." And the four survivors, I think three of them had actually been with Marshall, are just treated as American heroes and are also key because they help establish the date of the actual gold discovery. And Azariah is just so charming in his description of these festivities. I believe it's really the perfect ending for the book. Yes?
Certain men were brave. Do you believe
Well, I think it's a very typical reaction of older generations to veterans who come home hardened by the experience of war, changed by encounters with different cultures. I think that seldom in America have we seen as disgraceful a reception of American veterans as we saw during the Vietnam era, but in some ways it was very similar. Because, as I said, these guys weren't Brigham Young's favorite Mormons to begin with. And in many ways, many of the officers Young had had profound and enduring conflicts with and would for many of their lives. And these teenagers would do things like what they call the Spanish Rusty. A crowd of them come in from Cottonwood, and they've got young Mormon girls riding on their horses in front of them. And this is called the Spanish Rusty by the rest of the older Mormons. And the proper way to ride with a woman double on a horse is to have her sit on back. And the Mormons, they comment on this. These boys see the Mexicans riding with the women in front of them. And they recognize this is quite different and scandalous, but they do it anyway. And they come riding into the old fort. Half a dozen of them playing fiddles and generally raising hell and probably a little bit drunk. And so this outrages the elders. And they drum out six of them from the church and fine them all $25. And I think Abner Blackburn was among them, but he wasn't listed. And I think maybe he did it another time. But they let all these guys back in after a while. And I think they settled for the $25. But Amos E. Lyman, who's a pretty educated, broad-minded guy, I think expresses the cultural clash. You've got a bunch of old Puritans in many ways. The Mormon New Englanders came out of a very rigid culture. Despite polygamy, they were very conservative in their general social views. And to see these young men who were flouting their different appearance, their jargon, in some ways the money they'd acquired in California, just aggravated the hierarchy. And also, Brigham Young was in a bad situation. He had made promises he was simply unable to keep to the battalion families. He had made some unwise prophecies about all the men who were righteous coming back. And Young was very insecure at this period in his role as Mormon prophet. And he did not like being reminded that his prophecies hadn't worked or that his promises hadn't been kept. And he would viciously attack anyone who questioned his failure to do these things. Now, an ordinary leader could have said, look, it's not my fault that the river fell and all the bulk purchases we made in St. Louis wound up costing the people more than they could have bought them for at Sarpe's Trading Post. Or, you know, the idea of building a sawmill or a grist mill at winter quarters was a really good idea, and it just didn't work. But we did the best we could. That explanation wouldn't work for Brigham Young because he was God's oracle. And simple pastoral explanations to people of why did my beloved brother, husband, child die, dealing with this huge problem of human evil, Brigham Young was simply not prepared to do it. And his role as prophet was very, very constraining. He was very insecure with it. And I think it led him to some unwise and essentially emotional responses to these situations. Bonham Reiser says, this guy came down and he said something about him being a free agent or going off and raising Cain, and Rockwell's very much peripherally involved in all this stuff. But for some reason, there's an American soldier writes a letter reporting that Rockwell's been arrested with these counterfeiters. But Rockwell leads one of two parties up the Spanish Trail in the spring of 1848 and gets away. I think they may have taken a look at him and decided, we're not going to prosecute this guy. And they may have felt that there was really conflict over whether the military authorities could prosecute a civilian crime, and they don't. They turn it over to the local alcaldes and officials. More interesting are the other characters like Howard Egan. Egan, there's just hilarious material about Howard Egan. Lee is writing about some of the depredations that happen against American Army officers. And the surgeon, George Sanderson, who we've got some new material about, is very unpopular. And Sanderson has a watch stolen, and Lee says, somebody broke into the surgeon's trunk and stole his watch. And a couple of days later, he reports, somebody took the surgeon's mules and made off with them. Well, those are the mules that Howard Egan and John D. Lee take back up the Santa Fe Trail to winter quarters. And when Lee gets around to writing his confessions, he's not as disingenuous as he is in his journal, and he said, Howard Egan stole that watch and those mules. But again, you know, you got to recognize that these people felt aggrieved, and they felt they were justified in getting even. And if that involved printing bogus or stealing your enemy's livestock and possessions, it was fair game.
Thank you. Well, one question that you almost touched on there. As I read the book, the battalion members were living in fear of Dr. Sanderson's tendency to treat them all with calomel.
Now, the iron spoon.
They knew that Joseph Smith's brother died after having taken calomel as a treatment, and that was 20 years earlier. Now, was calomel a legitimate treatment for Dr. Sanderson, or do you suspect some of them suspected he was trying to kill them with the overdoses, or would you comment on calomel as a legitimate treatment?
Well, it was a horrible treatment, but it... Yes. Well, the Mormons came from a position of naturopathy, natural medicine. They were... largely, I think, through the influence of Willard Richards, Thompsonian religion or Thompsonian medicine people, and they did not like chemical, what was really, I think, more scientific medicine. Medicine was very primitive. Sanderson could not have gotten away with violating military regulations or standard military medical practice. He was doing what was approved standard treatment for these various diseases. Essentially, you gave everybody this nice dose of mercury for virtually anything that was wrong with them. Sanderson, I'm sure, did not like the Mormons, and the Mormons did not like Sanderson. But the officers would not have permitted him to poison the troops. The officers, so you look at Philip St. George Cook, he saved the lives of those men. If they had been led by, say, James Brown across today's Arizona and Mojave deserts, they would have died. They would have become a mob, then disintegrated and killed each other to get at water. But Cook protects the mules, who are essential to getting them through. He actually gets wagons all the way to California on Cook's wagon road. He wins these men's respect. Now, he would not have authorized Sanderson to poison the men whose duty it was to protect and to get their carcasses to California. Sanderson was a slaveholder. We actually track him through the Civil War when he disappears. He actually becomes a banker. He gives up poisoning people to become a banker. But I think Sanderson's been attacked, maybe not unfairly, but illegitimately, because he was applying standard military medicine, and he's been misrepresented as this embodiment of evil. Again, though, I'm sure that the contempt that the battalion felt for Sanderson was pretty much returned by Sanderson. But military medicine was just a disaster in the 1840s, as was most medicine. Thompsonian medicine had much to recommend it, because at least it didn't aggressively poison people.
I have a question concerning an allusion you made to Brigham Young's preaching about having averted a conspiracy against the Mormons. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know a little bit more about Brigham Young's beliefs as to that conspiracy, and did those beliefs include the Secretary of War's being complicit in the death of Joseph Smith?
Well, bring me up to date on the Secretary of War, Marcy?
Yes.
Was complicit in Joseph Smith's death?
I had read somewhere, and I can't remember where it was, that somebody was speculating, according to that there was the existence of a letter that the Secretary of War had somehow. Now, it's either the Secretary of War or it was President Polk's campaign manager prior to his election that was somehow complicit in this, and that there was some connection to, and this may be completely just, you know, legend. I don't know. But you kind of struck a chord when you mentioned Brigham Young's believing that he had averted some sort of conspiracy.
Well, I'd be very interested to see a single piece of documentation supporting Democratic involvement in the death of Joseph Smith. The Mormons were political allies of Polk. Sam Brannon boasted that without the Mormons, Polk wouldn't be president because the block of Mormon votes swayed the election in New York, which was crucial to his election. Marcy would not have been Secretary of War in 1844, and I'm not sure who. I don't think Amos Kendall, who is involved with some shenanigans with the Mormons, was campaign manager. And I'm not sure there really was a position like that. I would class this as slanderous Mormon legend. And I would certainly put the charges that James K. Polk conspired with Thomas Hart Benton and other powerful figures to slaughter the Mormons in winter quarters is a lie. And it's not just a lie, it's a damn lie. James K. Polk gave charity to the Mormon refugees on the Missouri River. He gave $10 to, the name eludes me, but to a begging missionary who came to the White House. And not only did Polk give this guy $10, but James Buchanan, who I think was Secretary of State, gave the begging missionary $10. Now, if he was going to slaughter the Mormons, why is he giving them charity? And even more scandalous, and I think I asked on our list, and one of the lists we're on about this, Mrs. Polk, who is quite a humanitarian, I believe sponsors a benefit for the Mormons on the Missouri, which had become a national scandal, to supply relief and food to these people. And the conditions of the Mormons under these circumstances really horrified the nation and did evoke a charitable response, which I don't think is documented at all any place in Mormon history. But the essential charge against Polk is that Thomas Hart Benton came to him in the spring of 1846 and said, okay, if you're going to recruit these Mormons, we want this deal. If they don't accept the enlistment, if they won't support the United States, I want the right to raise militias in Missouri, Illinois, Kentucky, and maybe Arkansas, and take that militia and slaughter the Mormons, exterminate them. And allegedly Polk said, okay, that's a deal, for obscure political reasons. Now, the trouble with these charges, which are leveled by Brigham Young by the summer of 1847, is there is not a shred of evidence to back them up. And in fact, as we document, if you go and look at Polk's journal, he makes a vigorous defense of the Mormons. He tells Illinois Senator Semple, who wants the Mormons stopped from going west for some odd reason, he could no more send the army out to stop the Mormons than he could send them out to stop the Methodists. Every American has a right to go wherever they want, and they all have the right of religious freedom, and he's not going to mess with the Mormons. Now, the trouble with this conspiracy theory, as I've said, is there is not a shred of evidence to back it up. I think it's part of Brigham Young's plan to shift blame for what happens with the battalion, the negative consequences. It's his refusal to accept responsibility for some of his own failures. He's trying to cover up the favor that the government did to the Mormons. And this becomes a prime piece of Mormon propaganda. Now, I'm particularly aggravated by it because I spent 10 years thinking, well, maybe there's something to it. Polk's the most brilliant politician who's ever been in the White House. He knew the Mormons were going to enlist the battalion because they'd asked for help, and he'd given it. So he really wasn't at risk in cutting such a deal with Benton, who might not be beyond such a devious scheme. So I spent years and years and years trying to find some documentary evidence to support these charges. It's not there. In a scandalous entry in the Mormon Experience, Davis Bitten and Glenn Leonard, or maybe Arrington, charge that there might be some papers in Thomas Kane's papers that would back this up. Well, bring them on. Let's see where they are, because it is a malicious lie, and it damns the memory of a great American president who is one of the great friends of Mormons in the West. And it wasn't until last spring before last, as we were finishing the book, that I found a reference to Thomas Stenhouse's account of the battalion. And in a single sentence, he explained to me why this story was told and retold and retold. It was a constant theme in the Journal of Discourses. And he said, "No subject that Brigham Young used to rouse hatred of the federal government was so effective as the Mormon Battalion story. It was a great piece of propaganda, and it was a damn lie."
Good, thank you.
We have about 5 minutes. Any other questions for Will? Will, I'd like to ask one question then, may be appropriate as we end here today. Did the battalion members, most of whom were very young, ever in subsequent years have reunions like the Screaming Eagles or the submarine forces of World War II and other military?
You bet. Oh, and that's a great lead-in. These guys, especially as time passed, and it became 30, 40, 50 years since they'd had these experiences, began to recognize what they'd actually done, and society somewhat slowly came around to it. The first annual reunion of the Mormon Battalion was this event sponsored by Brigham Young in 1855, in which they get up and tell the ram in the thicket story, which is the lie about President Polk. And they denounce the government, and they have a whole set of toasts that get more and more radical as the toasts go on. And there's actually a toast that is a backhanded denunciation of John D. Lee and Howard Egan. But and Brigham Young, it's a really classic Brigham Young talk, because he pulls in his horns. You almost never hear Brigham Young apologize for something. And he doesn't quite do it in this talk, but he gets awfully close. He says, "Some people have said that I said some unkind things about the battalion." And he goes, "Well, you know, maybe sort of." But that's the first evocation of their memory. And then every Pioneer Day, you'd have a group of battalion veterans who'd get together in March. And as time goes by, there's a big reunion that's held in Chicago of Mexican War veterans, I think in 1876. Abner Blackburn went, got a ribbon. But they become more and more hallowed and respected as the years go by. And in the Jubilee, the 50th anniversary, there's a big party to celebrate the surviving battalion, the battalion survivors. And we've got a picture of one of the pictures taken of the event. Some of the guys in the picture aren't Mormon Battalion veterans. So, of course, it's obviously by that time an element of social status. But they're very proud of what they've done, and I think they're deservedly proud. Now, this I'm very delighted with. This is our paperback book. It just came out Tuesday, August 1st. And this is an image that I bet you few Mormon Battalion experts had ever been aware of. It is a banner, I believe, drawn, painted by a Mormon Battalion veteran, and it was carried in one of these Pioneer Day, or many of these Pioneer Day celebrations. It is as accurate a graphic portrait of the Mormon Battalion as exists. It shows them on the march, formed up in ranks. It shows the large baggage train and the slogans written on the wagons. The baggage train winds around, disappears behind a hill on which you have Indian teepees. And they're led probably by Jefferson Hunt on a horse, but it might well be Philip St. George Cook. It is a stunning graphic evocation of the battalion. And we were able, through the offices of the Mormon, or the Daughters of Utah Pioneers, which has this banner hanging in their main speaking room at the Daughters Museum, to get a black and white photo from Norma Ricketts. We then gave it to Michelle Sellers, who's the graphic artist who's done virtually all of the covers of these USU paperbacks, and she recreated much of the color. So here we've revived this great graphical image of the Mormon Battalion, and I think it's one of the delights of what we were able to bring back. It's one of the not a voice from the dust, but definitely one of the images from the dust that we were able to bring back to life.
Thank you. We appreciate Will's presence here. His book is on sale either here after the session or in the book room in the Sunstone Symposium. Our time is gone, and we thank Scott for his good remarks. Scott and I both enjoyed the book, and we hope that you'll take the opportunity to read it. Thank you.
Thanks for coming.